Blog Talk Radio. The following program is brought to you by Firefly Willows LIVE.
Hi, my name's John Carosella, and I'm your host for Convergence on Firefly Willows LIVE. Convergence is to consciousness as gravity is to the material world. In small amounts, gravity is overwhelmed by every other fundamental force of the universe. But gravity has something nothing else has. It's cumulative. The more matter you collect, the more gravity you get, until it becomes the most powerful force of the material world. I think convergence is like that too. Only in this case, we're working with truth. The more truth we collect, the more convergence we experience. Connections, relationships, resonance of ideas and concepts, science and mysticism. Lately, deep truths just seem to be coming together, even as many of the illusions around us are falling apart. As within, so without. As above, so below. I know I'm feeling it, and I'll bet you are too. For the next 90 minutes, we'll be exploring concepts and topics that in some way or another bring us around to a deeper truth. Join me and my guests for this week's experience of Convergence. Hi, I'm John Carosella. Welcome to the Firefly Willows LIVE Weekly Roundtable. And with me, joining me for today's roundtable are my co-hosts, Deb Carosella.
Morning.
Heisi Lutmers.
Hello.
And Mildred Lynn McDonald.
Good morning.
And we are going to talk today about the power of music. You know, we all experience music. We experience music so much in today's culture. And in so many different ways. It's fun to reflect on how music has been with the human animal, and how it's evolved and has had a powerful presence in human culture and human experience. You know, we have a lot more different kinds of music today, but we've always had music with us. We've always had, you know, for as long as we've had voices and could tap sticks together or bones together, we've had percussion, rhythm, and song. But there's so many different kinds of music, and it's undeniable that music has power. So what I want to invite my co-hosts today to explore and talk about is, what kinds of music do you gravitate to? What kind of musical experience are you drawn to? How does it make you feel? And what is the nature of the power that you're experiencing when you're in the embrace of that music? Of course, one of the reasons I want to bring this up in today's roundtable is because my featured guest on the show today is Stephen Halpern, who is a Grammy-nominated artist, one of the fathers of New Age music, and in particular did some of the early research in the scientific aspect of healing music and healing sounds. So, you know, we have our own natural attraction to the different kinds of music, and I just thought it would be fun to share what those experiences are like for each of us. Anybody want to jump in?
Sure, John. When I think about music and feel music, it's usually to enhance or complement an aspect of what's going on with inside my body. So for example, if I feel I need more grounding, and the way I would know that is if I quiet myself and go inside and breathe and detach, if I find I need to ground myself, then I really like music with a strong beat. And there's one song that I listen to. It's from a Native American group called Brulé, and it's called Stomp Dance.
We'll be right back.
And all I have to do is listen to that, and I'm up on my feet, and I'm connecting with the earth. On the other hand, I may need some music to uplift me. I may be too involved in what I'm working on, and I'd like to release some of that energy and move outside of myself. And then I'd use something that's lighter, perhaps classical, maybe something like Barcarolle from Tales of Hoffman. That's another favorite of mine. So the bottom line for me is that music is a tool that I can use to help calibrate my energy through my different chakras. And recently, because I've just moved to a new location, I find that the music of the forest and the music of the birds and always the music of the ocean is of particular interest and appeal. So that's my two cents worth on music.
So how does your experience of nature's sounds compare or correlate to the grounding music or the aerifying, uplifting music?
I find that the music from nature, I tune in more. So it's as almost as if the birds are talking to me. I don't have a clue what they're saying, but I am listening very intensely. So it's like fine-tuning your channel. Whereas the grounding music that I mentioned previously or the classical uplifting music, that can be background music for me.
Oh, okay. So
when I tune into nature, it's very acute. It's a fine honing into nature. And I'm at the ready to receive the information, but it's not in English, unfortunately.
And you said earlier in our prep, you talked about balancing.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I pay attention to where my energies are going, and I use music as a tool to help balance whatever's going on with me so I'm in a balanced state. And how did I learn to do that? I've trained myself to do that. So I believe I have a little bit of innate ability, like many, many people. With some time and attention and practice, you can become really good at it. So that once you're identifying what you need to balance, you can apply the medicine of music and shift almost immediately to where you want to be.
Oh, that's cool.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, well, it's certainly a handy skill to have. If you can, it's almost like feng shui, right? It's the musical version of feng shui. If your layout, if the energy of your room is a certain way, then when you go into the room, that energy can sort of help attune you to whatever the energy of the room is carrying. The same is true with music. If you need a boost in a particular chakra, if you know what tune to go to get it, it's like nourishment.
Yes, nicely put, John.
Yeah, it's interesting. Interesting. Deb, how about you?
I find that I enjoy encountering music from my youth. Not that it was that long ago.
We won't say.
No. But
if you name any songs or we play any in this segment, the people are going to know.
Well, but I think I enjoy there's something about the nostalgia familiarity aspect of music that you know, music that you spent a lot of time with. And when you hear it again, when I hear it again, it doesn't necessarily transport me back to there, but it's familiar. It's like home. It's like placing yourself back in a safe, comfortable spot. And that can be very comforting. It can be very satisfying. I also find that while I'm not overly familiar with it, whenever I hear it, when I encounter it, any music that has the flute or the pipes, Irish pipes, Scottish pipes, Native American flute music, there's something about the sound that really talks to me, that touches me. It's almost like I stop whatever it is that I'm doing and when I hear it, and it just floods and just fills me up completely. Thank you. In particular, like the jigs and the reels in the Celtic music, more so than the more lamentable music.
Lamentation-ish.
The lamentation.
I don't think lamentable is the word you're looking for.
I'm sure they wouldn't appreciate it being described as lamentable. But there's something about the power, the movement, the energy, I feel that there's so much packed into those. Most of those songs are very traditional and have been heard by people for many, many, many years. And they have such a long cultural association. I find that they take me somewhere, and I'm very, very happy to go there.
Do you feel it in a particular place in your body, or is it
in my chest, in my heart? It's just everything just goes, poof, just swells right up, and I just float away to wherever, and I want to move, and I can just picture the Irish Highlands and these long, open, sweeping vistas of waving grass and cloudy skies, and I'm just totally there.
Wow.
I like it. I love it.
That's pretty cool. Hi, C.
Well, first, it was interesting listening to Mildred. I realized that I think I like music and certain types of music both similar to her and very different than her. One similarly is probably the thing I'm drawn to the most is anything that is drum, beat, or rhythm oriented, and especially Middle Eastern kind of music, African kind of music, or Native American drumming kind of music. But I'm also very different in the sense that I love electronic music and what can be created through electronics. And any kind of music for me that is kind of trance-inducing or really takes me outside of myself is something that I tend to respond to. But I'm also very aware of the energy and how it can set the space and the energy in a space. And I'm very particular about how I choose music, either for a room that I'm going to be in if I'm going to be doing something or a ritual, or even just music that's playing in the background, say if I have people over to the house for dinner or something, because I will pick things that, even without them realizing, are perhaps stimulating or affecting them on certain levels. And when you were talking about chakras and things, there's an amazing CD by Jonathan Goldman called Chakra Chants. And he actually did scientific study for all of the, they're called seed sounds for each of the chakras, like Om for the first chakra, et cetera. And what frequency, based on the note and what frequency those are at, and then every instrument and voice and everything that's used for each of the chakras is modulated very strictly within those frequencies. So if I want to stimulate a particular chakra, or even help to raise the chakra vibration in a general sense for people in a room without even telling them, then I can play one track from that for the chakra, or I will play those tracks in order to move people from the first chakra up to the seventh chakra, so that over the course of, say, an evening or something, it kind of is elevating the mood and the energy of the space. Mm. But that also speaks to what I really prefer for music is more of a communal aspect or a communal experience. I'm not one to be all sit in a dark room and listen to a singer-songwriter and get all introspective and that kind of thing with it. I'd rather be in a concert or in a dance club or at an electronic music festival where there's a sense that the music suddenly brings everyone together and creates that awareness of our community. And it's not that we're losing our individuality, but it's we're much more aware of how we connect with the whole. It's like how that energy just kind of becomes a communal experience.
Right.
Like being an electronic music festival with the lights and everything enhance it, and it's almost like a trance experience or a journey.
It's an altered state of consciousness for sure.
Yeah. I mean, dubstep will make me feel like I'm on drugs.
Haze, lemon, lemon, haze, haze, resin, resin, cheese, cheese, lemon, lemon, haze, 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 resin, resin, cheese,
that just like
as if you would know.
Careful, I have to be careful when I listen to that music. You know, but to be like in a electronic concert and the music suddenly starts to swell or has these different things. I mean, one of the types that I really like is called trance, but it has these certain ways that it does it. And you know, it hits these points where suddenly everybody is jumping up and down, or suddenly everybody starts dancing, or something like that. And that to me is what music is all about.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that too. There's the chant dance kind of music. Like, you know, one of my favorite artists in that genre is actually a local artist, Liz Addison. I love her Kevo, you know, kinetic voice. Just it's vocal but chanty and lots of rhythm, and it makes you want to move, it makes you want to sing. Actually, the stuff that I like makes me want to express through my breath. It makes me want to sing, right? And if I'm in a place where or surrounded by sound that makes me want to sing, and it's usually that kind of trance chant kind of stuff that makes me want to do that. And the other stuff I like is the very ethereal, almost ambient kind of music. Or things like the Indian, classical Indian ragas, or Indian fusion music, Native American flute, hammer dulcimer. Hammer dulcimer is kind of like in between, because it has a percussive kind of experience, but it's also this really, really airy kind of sound. I love that. And for me, I think it's either a driver, right, that make me want to get up and move and sing, or it's this letting go. Mm-hmm. I get to let go into the domain of the music of the spheres, really, you know. And that's, so for me, the trance moment is that disappearing of the self into the ethers. And I love that stuff. So if you were to make music, how would you make it, right? Like, in other words, would you be singing? Would you be playing an instrument? Would you be drumming?
For me, it would be singing. One of my guilty little secret pleasures is watching Glee, because I adore show choir type songs, and that whole... In a sense, it's the community involvement. It's the, wow, wouldn't you really kind of like to live where suddenly everyone in the hallway
just broke out
and breaks out into song and is choreographed?
You're destined for Bollywood, I believe.
Right. But definitely, it would be voice. I am horribly inept at any kind of musical instrument. I have never been able to handle any kind of musical instrument, but voice. Singing is part of who we are as people, and
this is, you know, if I may humbly say, you have a magnificent musical instrument, that you're actually quite good with. And that is your voice. So
yeah, Deb, sing us a song.
We'll do that on another round table.
How about you, Mildred, then?
If I was to create music, yeah, I would create it on the piano.
On the piano.
Mm. That is my natural tool or the vehicle that music comes through me into the piano and back to me. That's the process.
Mm. Cool. All right. I see.
I'd probably say sitting in front of a computer or with an iPad.
So electronic.
Yep.
Yeah, yeah. And for me, it would be voice and percussion, some kind of percussion. Perhaps the hammer dulcimer,
mm.
but definitely the voice singing of some sort. So, all right. Well, thank you so much for joining me for today's roundtable. I hope I'd love to hear from our listeners about what music you love and how you prefer to make music and how it moves you in your body and how it moves you outside of your body. So join us on the Firefly Willows Facebook page, facebook.com/Firefly Willows, and comment under the roundtable post. We'd love
and
to
maybe
hear
even
from
put
you.
Links there to like a YouTube clip or something so people could also hear what it is that they're talking about.
Absolutely. We'd love to have that.
What a great idea.
That'd be a lot of fun. And then stay tuned for the rest of the show. Today we've got a great show on tap for you, and we'd love to hear from you. So thanks a lot, guys. Thanks for joining me.
Bye-bye.
Great talk, John.
Thank you.
Bye.
Exploring reality, the most intimate thing we do. Over the past year or so, I've been learning a lot and experiencing a lot about breathing. It dawned on me that breathing is an extraordinarily intimate act. Think about it. When you breathe, you take in random air molecules from all around you, through your nose, down your throat, and into your lungs, where they mingle with your insides. Indeed, they become part of you. And we do this constantly. It never stops. When you exhale, you push what was, just seconds ago, part of your very blood out into the world. So ethereal, this breathing thing, and yet so very, very messy and sanguinary. We allow our blood to touch the world in every breath. It's pretty spectacular when you think about it. I'll also admit that it can also seem a little gross and more than a little terrifying when you think about it this way. But that's what makes it fascinating and what compels me to explore this very fundamental intimacy. So I want to go a little bit deeper. It's not just any old air molecule that enters your body. It's an air molecule that has been profoundly affected by the environment in which it is floating. It's been zapped by cosmic rays, perhaps. Most certainly by a cell phone signal or two. It's vibrating with the heat reflected off the pavement, or the trees, or the foreheads of the people in the room. Each molecule we bring into such intimate contact with our inner physical being is a quiver with the energies present all around us, and, to greater or lesser degrees, all the energy that is radiating at all the frequencies from all directions. Poor little molecule, so profoundly bopped and bonked and spun about, and then in it goes. What happens when it gets there? Of course, it carries all those vibrations with it, right into the inner sanctum of the physical. Makes you long for some good, clean, natural, fresh air, doesn't it? The other side is just as interesting. When we exhale, the molecules we release carry with them the vibrations that are inside of us. So all the frequencies that are generated by the complex interactions of our functioning selves are present in each exhalation. It's interesting to think about what makes up those vibrations. Our physical state, to be sure, but also all the rest of us. Our moods, our thoughts, our dreams, our pettiness and our valor, all present in every exhalation. Perhaps the instantaneous energy signature of all of that is what our soul looks like in that very moment. Are we exhaling our soul profile written in the energy signature of our breath? If so, what we are inside ourselves fundamentally impacts the world outside of ourselves. And what is outside affects what we are becoming. What are you inhaling? Perhaps more importantly, what are you exhaling? The mystical traditions place great power in the breath. The power to create, destroy, rebalance, cleanse, heal, the list goes on and on. With this perspective, I have to agree. And recently, I've begun to experience this power directly. As I explore the crossover between deep physics, spirituality, and healing, and in particular, as I continue to study yoga and qigong, I sense and can sometimes manipulate the power of breath, this intimate, deep, essential power that we engage in all day without ceasing. It's very, very cool. We can argue over the magnitude of the impact, for sure. Perhaps someday we'll understand how to measure it all. I'll be excited when that happens, but also a little sad that the mystery is solved. Until then, I continue to explore and have no doubt that the breath has a powerful and intimate capacity to connect us to the world and the world to us. We'll be right back.
Firefly Willows, LIVE, is proud to support Underdog Railroad Rescue, a pending 501c3 organization based in Portland, Oregon. Underdog Railroad Rescue works directly with rescue groups in Southern California to rescue dogs who are on their last days in the high-kill shelters. They foster the dogs until they are healthy, get to know the dogs' personalities and needs, and help them find their forever homes. Find them on Facebook at facebook.com/underdograilroadrescue or contact them at underdogrr@gmail.com. This tip of the week from Underdog Railroad Rescue. When you pick up your dog, be sure to ask about his routine while in foster care or at the shelter. Keeping his routine as similar as possible for the first few days will reduce stress. Slowly introduce new foods and your schedule for feeding, toileting, and play exercise. Your dog will need family time and brief periods of alone time. Give him attention for good behavior, such as chewing on a toy or resting quietly.
Welcome back. This is Convergence. I'm your host, John Carosella, and with me for today's spirited conversation is Stephen Halpern. Stephen is a Grammy-nominated composer, recording artist, and producer whose healing music has helped millions worldwide to experience the blessings and benefits of deep relaxation and inner peace. Now, Chakra Suite, his debut release in 1975, was really one of the things that helped establish the quiet revolution and a new genre in contemporary instrumental music. To date, Chakra Suite has sold over 700,000 copies. Halpern's cumulative sales exceed 6 million units, and his current releases continue to set the standard of excellence in the field. Based on his own spiritual and health-related experiences, Stephen discovered secrets of combining
ancient sound healing traditions with quantum biology and energy medicine to produce recordings that support relaxation, stress management, yoga, meditation, massage, sleep, accelerated learning, and, of course, pure listening pleasure. So perfect for our show today. Welcome, Stephen Halpert.
Well, thank you. A pleasure to be here.
So I didn't know about you until I bumped into a reference randomly. And when I did research on you, I was amazed, stunned to find that you were one of the early guys in this field of ambient, new age, trancey music. And I can't wait to hear about what that was like to be a pioneer in this space back then. And so I want to talk about that in some depth. In your bio, you mentioned that you had spiritual and health-related experiences that led you to your discoveries. What were those like?
Well, there are two levels that I'll answer that. Number one were the experiences directly with the music or sound. The main one I referenced, though, came out of experiences playing high-energy jazz music in the John Coltrane paradigm, where, as a trumpet player, sitting with an incredible bunch of musicians, all the things that I had studied with my left brain, analytical mind and practice schedule, at one point the trumpet started playing itself. And that was when I learned how to shift gears, shift levels, and tap into a higher level of creativity. That got me on a course to start learning about the ancient tradition of healing music, of tuning into one's muse, one's source of inspiration. And that was what carried me through my 4 years of college and the after-hours study as a jazz musician, and really got me into spiritual states. I was also starting to experience deep and great levels of health problems, and many were stress-related problems, which I didn't even know about up until a certain point. I just thought that was normal, and everybody went through that. But it was when I came out to California for what I thought was a two-week visit at the end of 1969 that I had an experience outside of Santa Cruz, California, sitting underneath the majestic redwoods in a basically what I found out later was a sacred grove, a spiritual energy center in the area. And I had an experience where I started hearing different kind of music than I had ever really played before, but I had kind of known intuitively that it should exist, and I've been praying to learn what healing music would sound like in the late 20th century, as opposed to just reading about what Pythagoras or the ancient Greeks or the Egyptians used for healing music, because no one knew exactly what the sounds sounded like.
Oh, so there were references in history to healing power of music, but you couldn't. But there was no recordings.
Exactly. David soothing Saul in the Bible. Well, you know, you got to remember, you know, a couple thousand years ago, you did not have music everywhere coming out of TVs and lampposts and et cetera, et cetera. So any musical sound would be unique and interesting. But David had a very simple, probably a five-string harp or lyre. You couldn't play a lot of chords. Did he play the notes going fast or slow or one at a time, together, going up, descending, ascending? None of that anybody knows. So many of us would, you know, take guesses or think, well, we think it sounds like that, but no one really knows. So my question was, whatever that was, it's a very different world nowadays. I'm having these experiences in meditation where I start hearing this incredible new music, and then right after that, I start being able to play it when I sit down at a piano. And I'm a trained guitar player, trained trumpet player. I had a very introductory familiarity with piano. But piano was the instrument through which this kind of music could manifest. And that also became the music that first healed me from my hyper-stressed, over-the-top lifestyle. And music was a non-drug, non-fattening, energy-renewable, legal way to keep myself in better health, to feel good, to release those endorphins, which, you know, the endogenous neurohormones, the joy juice.
Right.
And I like being able to control, you know, how I feel. And in college, we were already introduced to the concept of going back to William James, of exploring different spectrums of consciousness. And
right.
That was always very much of interest to me. And I was naturally attracted to various forms of altering consciousness. And the ones that were natural and more organic, and definitely ones that I could do for myself with my own neurophysiology, learning how to tune my own brain, well, that was it for me. So I've always been, whether it's yoga or, you know, Tai Chi or meditation or Tantra lovemaking or music, that was always first and foremost. Entertainment was not my main reason for being a musician. I was a musician because that was how I made my connection to the divine. That was my connection to the quantum field.
So there's so many directions I want to go here all at once. Can you share the trumpet started to play itself? Now there's the idea in the Indian classical music that the raga cannot be learned unless it's taught by someone who has become the music.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So this, like, the idea that the trumpet started to play you, right? Or the trumpet was playing itself with you as the host, right? And I've had a couple of, you know, experiences, spiritual experiences where, in particular with water and with fire, right? Where I was sitting by a fire and the fire began to speak to me. And then what I realized was that as much as the fire was speaking to me, there was also an intelligence that was speaking to me through the fire.
Oh, yes.
So it was like there was dimensionally, there was two unique experiences happening. And I wonder if maybe you can share a little bit about what that, about the trumpet, that experience was like for you.
Well, sure. Up until that point, having studied scales and chords, and if you have these chords, you play these scales, and these melodies go with these things, and if you're playing a blues format, this chord follows that, and you want to show off the harmonic chord changes. That was a lot of left-brain stuff. It was one learns on trumpet to move one's fingers and hold one's embouchure at a certain way. But I was always aware that it was me thinking the ideas, and then I'd play them. And trumpet, being a wind instrument, we take this little piece of metal that's the mouthpiece, you stick it on your lips, you have to get your whole body involved. So it was a very visceral and physical act.
Mm.
And it was, when I would wake up every morning, my first thought was not, boy, I'd like to put some, you know, hard metal on my lips and, you know, work my embouchure and my diaphragm and stand right so I don't hurt myself and get my teeth aligned this certain way. So it was always an effort. I mean, it was good. It was a workout. I liked getting, you know, working a sweat on it, you know, on a certain level, and know that I was working out on trumpet. Mm-hmm. But in the middle of this solo, when I'm sitting in with this jam session of one of the very first weekends up at the University of Buffalo, suddenly it was effortless to blow. I didn't even feel the trumpet on my lips. It was like an extension of my body, extension of my nervous system, and incredible melodic lines were coming out. My fingers were moving, but I wasn't telling them what to do.
Mm.
And it felt like I was levitating. It was
an
incredibly blissful experience, and I didn't know what happened, but the musician in charge, was like the master teacher of Buffalo, was helping that happen, and he knew that this was going to be my initiation, my opening into this level. That's why he called me out of the audience, because I guess he could see the energy or whatever it was. I was ready for it, and it blew my mind. And it was like, man, that was the best I ever played. And people who knew me after I sat down, I said, man, when did you get so good? And I didn't even know what they meant at first. And they were telling me, I just remember that it was like in a dream. It was effortless. It was wow, if this is what it means to be a trumpet player, now I know. Before that, I played trumpet. Then I was a trumpet player. And I've had that happen on guitar, but it happened from the beginning with the piano, which is much easier because I'm sitting in meditation, you know, with my back straight, and I can just wiggle my fingers, which doesn't take me out of the meditative state, and I would be able to listen to the overtones and the put the sustain pedal down. So that's how that was, and it's been since that day in late November 1969 that the piano has been, a keyboard instrument has been my primary instrument for meditation, and always, particularly in the studio, an opportunity for magic to happen.
So now let's just go back to the Redwoods, you know, because I live here in the Bay Area and have an affinity for the Redwoods. I have a beautiful redwood tree in my backyard, and I love to go into the Redwoods. When you were there, were you just going for a walk, or did you decide to specifically choose to meditate there? Or
actually, it's a very, very clear story that I've told now, but for a certain amount of time, I didn't even tell most people this. But I had come out to California after my jazz rock band had finished a recording session in New York. We were based in Buffalo. I had a graduate fellowship. I was getting paid to be a graduate student at the University of Buffalo to go back to. And we thought our career was going to be, we had a bunch of musicians. Anyway, I was taking a two-week break before I go back to grad school. Came out, I wanted to see and check out the San Francisco jazz scene as well as the rock scene. And I also was on a quest to see the William Blake exhibit and his museum at the University of California, Santa Cruz, because they had the original manuscripts in gold leaf that William Blake had engraved. And it was supposed to be like an LSD trip without LSD just to look at those. And Blake was one of our main guys that we studied back in Buffalo. So I'm hitchhiking from San Francisco, and the second people that pick me up say, well, why are you going to Santa Cruz? And I tell them why, and says, well, we got a better place. There's this place up in the hills outside of Santa Cruz where they study astrology and Zen and stuff like you're talking about. So they take me up there, which is up now 9 miles outside of town, up 2 miles road, drop me off at a bunch of mailboxes and say, it's down that road. And it's like there's 18 arrows pointing in different directions. They drive away, and I'm going, what did I just get myself into? And just then, this guy comes up, goes to the mailbox, looks at me and says, are you the guy applying for the staff position at our retreat center? And I said, no. I was just told about you, and if you're offering, I will take it. And he says, cool, come back, meet the staff. In a couple hours, you can walk down this road. There's like a little park a mile down the road. So that's why I'm walking down. I don't know what I'm getting into. I've never been outside of San Francisco. It's my first time in California. Everything is different than the vegetation we have back east, because I grew up in Long Island. And I walk down the road. I notice my fingertips are buzzing. I say, this is a very interesting place. And I get down to where there's a clearing where the redwoods are all grow in a circle around the center, which is open. And I'm admiring that. And suddenly, I'm basically, it's almost like someone is pushing down on my shoulders saying, sit down. And I just virtually instantaneously went into a deep meditation. I could not meditate. It wasn't something, oh, I think I'd like to meditate. It was, I had no choice. And in that, I basically heard, I had been creating a graduate study program to investigate and explore and read about everything that was available in the field of music and consciousness. That sounds like a lot, but there wasn't very much written, so it was going to be an easy graduate fellowship. And I got a chance and said, you've been praying to hear what music sounded like in ancient Egypt and what healing music would be like in the present day. This is what it sounds like, and your job is to share this with the world. So I don't even know what they mean at that point. I mean, it's one of the only times I've actually, if not heard a voice, heard the thoughts. And then when I go back down the road, I follow the directions, but the center is on the side of a hill. So the building they were telling me about was underneath the one that I walk into at ground level. Ground level, there's a big workshop room, nobody home, and a piano. I sit down at the piano, and I'm going into the zone. I start playing what I was hearing in the woods, under the redwoods. My fingers are moving, and I'm just going deeper and deeper, and I'm not even aware what I'm playing. I'm not even hearing pretty much a lot of what I'm playing. I'm just in the zone. And then about 15 minutes later, I hear some rustling in the room, and they say, "Who is this guy?" There's 10 people sitting in the room now, and the guy that met me at the mailbox says, "Oh, remember I told you I met a new staff person?" Someone else said, "Hire him." And that was how my life changed. So, you know, sometimes, like the Beatles saying, you know you're in play and you are anyway. This was like, I knew I was in a movie, and yet I knew it was real life, and if this was a movie, I wouldn't believe it, and yet it just happened. And the fact that it happened was, instead of reading about magical coincidences that happened to other people, suddenly I knew that was not just metaphor. I just had a life-changing experience. It was ratified by other people that had never heard music like this and loved it and said it took them into these blissful, inner peaceful realms. And I was off and running.
Wow.
And that was when my life changed. I called Buffalo that night and said, "Please send my books. Please send, you know, my clothes and my records." And mostly I didn't get much of any of those. Especially my records. And so literally at that point, all I had was the clothes on my back.
Oh, my goodness.
Trumpet and car. And that's when I started over. People, you know, would give me some things.
Wow. So it seems like you didn't really have too much difficulty making that decision to stay in California.
No, it was the easiest decision and the fastest decision I ever made. I was known for being kind of like, "Well, you make up your mind already. Well, maybe this," and then the left brain and the right brain. It was the most obvious and insistent, and followed my heart, followed my body. Every cell in my body said, "This is your life." And I could have said, "Well, I'll come back to California after I finish my graduate fellowship. I have money and a salary in Buffalo and a great band. I have nothing in California." But it was like, you could live and learn about healing music and do healing music out here, or study it and read about it. Buffalo, you want to read about it, you want to do it.
Wow. Well, so your first CD is the Chakra Suite. Is that the kind of music you heard?
Yes.
In the forest?
That's exactly what it was. And that was the reason I did the album.
Well, so let's listen to a piece from the Chakra Suite. This is First Chakra C. Wow, that was that's such. First of all, it's very beautiful, and secondly, it has a deep effect. What is special about that piece and the other pieces on Chakra Suites?
It's a 7-sequence series of 3-minute compositions that use sound to stimulate and activate each of the chakras. Each of the songs individually, though, shifts your brainwaves within seconds into a deep alpha state. there isn't a steady rhythm. So your heart is not manipulated and entrained by the rhythm of the music, certainly not sped up. And when you give your heartbeat and give your body a choice, it naturally shifts into a very relaxed state for you so that you choose what is best for you. The other big thing that that this music has, of course, is the sound. It's like a series of tuning forks, very healing to the body. Very easy to assimilate. And number three, the fact that the music doesn't include the kind of harmonic and melodic anticipation factors that are built into most music. The music doesn't set you up. If I sing this little phrase, watch what happens in your body. Do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti. You're probably holding your breath. You know what note's supposed to happen.
Right.
And what note's going to follow. Well, that's setting you up. Relaxation only happens in the present moment, in the now. Meditation only happens in the present moment. If you're constantly projecting into the future where the music is going, you're never going to be balanced, you're never going to be relaxed, and that makes it that much harder for healing to happen. That turns out to be one of the major discoveries and contributions I've made, that my research showed way back in 1973, that when it comes to creating an effective stimulus and resource and ally to get people to shift into the relaxation state, with all the research that Dr. Herbert Benson has done since that came out after my album came out, that prove the importance and how fundamental the relaxation state, a true deep relaxation state, is in supporting our own self-healing energies, then that is a very important choice. When you're looking for music for entertainment, lots of music is great. When you're looking for music for relaxation, if you're using music that's the audio analog of caffeine, which is most music with a fast beat speeds up your heartbeat, and you can't relax if you have a fast heartbeat. Well, you can't relax if you're, even with slower music, if your brain is constantly anticipating where the music is going. And this scale experience, I used to joke about it as the scaleless interrupters phenomenon. The interrupted scale that keeps you in tension, in a state of tension. And it turns out that concept impacts people. They go, wow, I never thought of that. I never noticed that about the way that I respond to music. I was the guy that noticed my body going through changes when I was trying to relax and listen to classical music.
Right.
You know, I'm going, wait a minute. Is it me or are the people who are telling me that Mozart or Bach is the best for relaxation either have very different bodies than I do, or they have a belief system, or they've been programmed or taught in school by people who came before them that such music is the best.
You know, there's something interesting about this there's form and structure in the kind of music that you're talking about, the old fashioned, the melodic line, the anticipatory tension. That form and structure is ordered. It's highly ordered. And music that is more free-flowing, like we just heard with Chakra Suite, it dispenses with a big chunk of that form.
Yes.
But there's something interesting about this, too, which is where there's a paradox. And that is getting your brain waves into a particular frequency range, be it alpha or theta or delta. We often use rhythm to do that.
Yes.
And rhythm has structure. It has form. But there's something different. It seems I'm pre-associating here, so tell me if I'm crazy. But it's like a certain rhythmic structure is a container in which a whole bunch of freedom can exist. It's almost like there's a little tiny bit of order and then a lot of room for complexity that is not intrinsically ordered. Do you know what I'm saying?
I do. And I conceptualize it on this level. There's the macro and the micro. So the fundamental, most obvious effect of rhythmic music is to entrain our heartbeats to the beat of the music. That's a natural physiological phenomenon. If you have a fast beat, you can't tell your heart, ignore this external rhythm, beat slower, your heart is going to follow the beat of the music. But if you give your body a choice, and this is one of the great insights of one of my mentors, the famous researcher and author Itzhak Bentov, wrote the book Stalking the Wild Pendulum, that if you give your body a choice, it's going to choose an internal rhythmic flow that is most harmonious and most strengthening and healthful for you as an individual. And me as an individual won't necessarily be able to know what's best for you. That's on the physiological level. The brain is more micro in terms of the difference between the rhythm entrainment with beats, and rhythm is beats per minute. With brain waves, we're dealing with beats per second. And so, I mean, so much of this, we're biologically pre-wired and hardwired, it seems, to go into different states of trance and different responses. There are some ethnomusicologists that have shared some incredible insights on how music causes group trance, group hypnosis. It's well known in indigenous cultures, in Africa, in Asia, in South America, but not well known in America. But yet that tradition comes through through black gospel music, through contemporary R&B. If you've learned the secret codes, you can identify when that change, that a shift in consciousness is happening. So, and some people just do it and know it naturally, but right. It actually has been studied. And I've met some individuals that helped me learn the language, the secret code of rhythm in music and how that's functioning. That's another part. It's almost been a parallel part of my musical life, the music without rhythm or without an explicit rhythm, which is most of what I've been doing in my recordings, because there's an implicit rhythm. And I would share with you, John, that one of my secrets that I never mentioned for many, many years is that the beginnings of phrases, the pauses between some of these songs, I synchronize with the duration of a deep yogic breath.
Mm.
And I learned that from yoga. I built that into the music. I learned that if I encode that universal yogic rhythm of a deep breath, that makes it easier for other people to tune into that rather than impose a strict musical beat on them. But it's an autonomic and automatic response, very powerful. And that's in fact one of the reasons why I think so many people are turning on to the new album, Deep Alpha, and on its predecessor, Deep Theta, because this response can be immediate. In the same way, as soon as you hear a funky drum beat or something, you might snap your fingers or tap your toes. It's immediate. This is something that doesn't take 5 minutes or 10 minutes or an hour. Virtually within seconds, your heartbeat shifts. It happens that fast. And some people, like me, are much more aware of that than others. I've always been very hypersensitive to how sounds and rhythms in my environment are involuntarily and unconsciously affecting me. And that I was always the guy, before I started getting famous as a, you know, new age musician, for being the one that would complain about the ticking clock in a meditation room.
Yeah.
We're supposed to be meditating here. There are such things as silent clocks. I cannot meditate with a constant tick there.
There's an interesting thing. This reminds me of why it's so infuriating and frustrating to have a dripping sink.
Oh, yes.
In your bedroom, bathroom, you know? It's like, you're on the one hand, you're anticipating it and waiting for it because you want to entrain to it, because you're naturally entrained to it. On the other hand, it's not the rhythm you want when you're trying to sleep.
Exactly.
So either way, if it's a regular drip, it drives you crazy. If it's an irregular drip, it drives you crazy. So you learned a lot of this stuff. You did this biofeedback research in 1973. What did you focus on? And was there music involved in that biofeedback research?
Yes, absolutely. When I enrolled and applied to this special first-of-its-kind program, my feature, which was bringing us in touch with all the leaders of the human potential movement in its infancy, people like Michael Murphy from Esalen, and many of these teachers and individuals taught at Esalen. And the second place after Esalen Institute was Bridge Mountain Institute, which is where I landed quite by accident, having never heard of it, that day in November. So I was incredibly well-placed. And then this program, every week, would have leaders in the field. So we had Werner Erhard before he was even Werner Erhard, and John Lilly and Stan Krippner and so many other wonderful teachers. And I wanted to study and compare my music with the most relaxing classical music to see if there was a difference, as shown in brainwave analysis with EEG, with GSR, galvanic skin response, in terms of stress level, and in terms of the human biofield, the electromagnetic energy field, or aura. So what we found in that research, I hired some great scientists to do the study, since obviously I didn't know anything about running studies, and Dr. Krippner as my mentor and to help set up the experimental protocol so that it would be bulletproof. And what we found was that when it comes to relaxation, classical music was blown out of the water by the song that we just heard, Keynote C, and music that I was composing in that style. The instrument had an effect, but it was the context. It was such a change and allowed their body to do what their body knew how to do naturally, get into a higher state of coherence and balance, and that supports healing on many levels. This would show up in the aura within 30 seconds. And that was amazing. What changed the world of music therapy on a level, because up until that point, they said it takes probably an hour, certainly at least 20 minutes by the famous isotonic principle, that you need to start where the individual is and slowly shift their state to get them into a relaxation. And I said, John, hey guys, I'm from New York. I don't have 20 minutes. What do you have that can get me there in a minute? And I remember being told in those first meetings, oh, that's impossible. There's no music that can get you there to make that shift. That you have to do it gradually. And I showed them my research and said, not anymore, because I got this new music that's done something that no music has done before.
So I want to touch a little bit on these different brainwave states, right? You have alpha, theta, and delta. But should we listen to something from deep alpha?
Absolutely.
Before we do that? All right, let's listen to it.
And folks, right, as we go, listen, right at the very beginning, you might hear something that sounds like wah, 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 and then the music covers it up.
Okay.
And I'll tell you about that in a moment.
All right, deep alpha part two. Okay, so you're taking us somewhere here with this alpha state. Where are we going?
Well, the difference between this series is that virtually all of our music is designed and coming from a place of evoking your innate automatic relaxation response. That's referencing the work of Dr. Herbert Benson and his best-selling book, The Relaxation Response. My mentor, as I mentioned, Itzhak Bentov, showed that when you give the body a chance to shift into a relaxation state, there's a natural resonance that happens in the brain and the body that's about 8 cycles per second. So in other words, most all of my music is designed to get your body and brain and mind pulsating, because the brain has a variety of frequencies at which the electrical activity of the brain have been measured, between 1 to 3 cycles per second for what is called delta related to sleep, theta between 4 and 7, alpha between 8 and 12, and beta, normal waking consciousness like we're in now, between 13 and 39 cycles per second. There's new research that says there may be some other interesting frequencies, but that's been the traditional overview of brain waves. So naturally, your body is predisposed, because the Earth itself, John, has a natural brainwave, a natural resonance of about 8 cycles per second. So that's why.
Okay, so that's the Earth's 8 cycles is the Earth's frequency.
Essentially, 7.8 to 8 cycles per second. There are a couple of other key harmonics, but that's a fundamental harmonic. What I started looking at 30 years ago was enhancing that entrainment response by incorporating an 8 hertz frequency into the music. And there's a number of different, well, a couple of different ways of dealing with what's called beat frequencies or oral entrainment, et cetera. And I encode that as a musician, rather than if you listen to some of the other companies that market brainwave entrainment, it'll sound like this.
Right, right.
And that gives me a stomachache, gives me a headache. It's not pleasant to listen to. Yes, it'll get you into that desired state, because your brain will naturally match that. But it's like getting hit on the head, side of the head with a 2x4. That'll get your attention. But, you know, if somebody gently caresses the side of your head, that'll get your attention also. I caress you with music and give you the option of choosing with most of my music, but with the deep alpha, I encode a subtle 8 cycle per second, 8 hertz brainwave, and that locks you in immediately into the deep alpha brainwave entrainment state, which then automatically puts you in easier access and direct entrainment, direct resonance with the dominant electromagnetic field of the Earth. And even the small sample that you just played will take people there quickly. And it's like seeing something out of the corner of your eye. You're looking straight ahead, but you're aware of something. Something catches your attention. In deep alpha and in deep theta, my albums, I'm able to do that. And some of this was just trial and error, because there were no books that tell you how to do it, that I hit upon a way of creating my binaural beat tones, my sonic entrainment matrix, and modulating the level and the volume that I blended with the music. And I would usually add that after I did the music. I started wondering, well, what would happen if I actually listened to music at different frequencies in my headphones? Would I hear different music? Would I compose and record different music? And these last couple albums actually began as my own personal research project. And I worked with different frequencies, and they're all beautiful. But for me, when I got down to deep theta at 4 cycles per second, it was like the doors of heaven opened up, and I started hearing a whole bunch of new music. I started playing music. Music started flowing through me. Music started happening. I didn't even hear all of it till I listened to playback later on in the studio. And that's when I knew I was really onto something. And then I started sharing that with the world, and a lot of other people said, whoa, this is different. This, you are onto something.
Cool. So, you know, part of this leads me to thinking about what the ancients knew. And part of this leads me to wondering about your references to shamanic experiences and the shamanic initiations and how that affected you. So can you share a little bit about the pick a direction you want to go, because I want to hear about both.
Absolutely. So before I knew about brainwaves, and I would say 67, but definitely 1968, the circle of musicians and poets that I was playing with and hanging out with in Buffalo included major poets and writers who organized major conferences at the University of Buffalo. And amongst those famous writers who had come up there were William S. Burroughs. Burroughs had just come back from Morocco and had hung out and smoked kief with the master musicians of Jajouka, and came back and was writing about also Led Zeppelin and the use of music and magic in the shamanic sense that was first starting to happen with major outdoor concerts at baseball stadiums and arenas. And he was saying, you know, part of why this is happening, folks, you may not know it, but there's an ancient tradition of music to evoke trance states amongst audiences, whether a huge group like at the rites of Eleusis in ancient Greece, or around a ceremonial fire in ancient Egypt, or Native American tribes around the world. So that was when I started learning about that, started reading about it, and that was when I really started understanding the power of music and rhythm to entrain, to entrance, to get people to breathe together, to get people to be in sync. We didn't have all those words back then. But subsequently, other scientists have studied some of that, and other ethnomusicologists have spoken about and written about the unbroken shamanic tradition where the music, the chants, the rhythms, for instance, in African religions, 90% of those religions are religions in which people go into trance with the music. And when I really learned about trance in music, I had been experiencing both gospel ceremonies and never getting to Haiti or to those kind of Afro-Cuban, Afro-Haitian ceremonies. But I had some experiences, and I met a master drummer who was transitioning into the priesthood, who turned me on to the work of Morton Marx and some other incredible ethnomusicologists who have been studying this. The amazing thing, though, John, is that no one that I've ever spoken to has pretty much ever heard of it. It's locked into small academic circles in $80 books that people don't buy, but I was first given kind of a secret private copy of Morton Marx's graduate thesis on trance and secret codes in music, and since 1973 have been able to contextualize what I hear in that way, that there is so much trance going on. People like the Grateful Dead were aware of that. A lot of the great rock performers were aware of the energy they were working with, and many were not. But it was something that they would maybe speak amongst themselves but wouldn't share with the public. And then people like Jimmy Page were very much aware and studied the use of sound and music and magic. But the larger use of this, the two main research areas are the military, who's always interested in this, both to get higher performance from their own soldiers and how to maybe control or
weaken
the enemy, exactly. Yeah. And this goes back to ancient Greece, where there are certain modes and certain scales that you would play to weaken the enemy to strengthen yourself. And in Africa, that tradition was also there. And so that was it. And the other ones now, of course, are advertisers.
Right, right. Okay. So we talked a little bit about the ancients, right? The way that the Greeks used rhythm to get their troops in shape. What about things like the Gregorian chants and Tibetan singing bowls and things like that.
Absolutely. Well, now you're tapping into the other tradition that you asked about earlier. So we have the rhythmic and the non-rhythmic. And if we first look at Gregorian chant, there is no steady rhythm there. In fact, the music, when it was notated, did not have bar lines, measure lines. It wasn't four beats. It was timed to the, basically, the amount of time that someone could hold, you know, to take a deep breath and sing.
Yeah, time to the breath, yeah.
Yes. Well, even more to my own tradition is Tibetan bowls, Tibetan singing bowls, Japanese temple bowls, where you strike this instrument, bong, and you listen to the sustain fading away. Even church bells, when they're played individually, bong, and particularly with Tibetan bowls, you will hear that little with many of them, if they're well made. And that, John, is the cultural antecedent to the computer-assisted or mechanically assisted brainwave entrainment tones that I'm using.
So
in other words, these were built into those instruments. And I remember when I first heard them, I said, well, these are kind of boring, that you just hit a note and it doesn't go anywhere. I mean, that was when I was still in my left brain analytical mode. And then I was at a seminar with Alan Watts. He said, listen carefully. Listen to the furthest away note. And you listen as the overtones change and you start hearing the fundamental and then the harmonic overtones if it's a good bowl. And it was a trip. And I heard all this lush harmonic warmth and resonance and interest going on. And I was hooked. What I didn't know is that those wah-wah-wah-wah-wah-wah-wah sound were actually brainwave entrainment tones that were built in naturally to the instrument.
So overtones and the over harmonics are naturally entraining.
I believe that's part of it, but specifically, and you find, and I know because I played a lot of different bowls, and some bowls feel very flat, very vanilla.
Oh,
very,
right, okay.
Mm-hmm. And then others, and I found some of these in weird places, in a used record store once, in a bookstore, in a hospital gift shop. The three or four bowls together, I hit two, put them right back on the shelf, hurt the next one, and it's wah, 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 wah. My brain just instantly goes into, you know, this other state, and I go, that's for me. And someone else might find another bowl interesting. I don't know. But I know that not all bowls are created equal, but that flickering, that wobbling, that vibrato sound is the natural beauty of certain bowls more than others, and those are the ones that I bought in my own collection. And a lot of them are older, but there are some new masters that make them. But that's, for me, how I decide whether a bowl is one, if it's a good bowl, or if it's really psychoactive.
Right.
And when I first heard my electric piano, I matched up intuitively the sound of the vibrato, the knob setting, whether it was wah, 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 really fast or slow. And now, when I finally went to brainwave entrainment and started working with deep theta and different frequencies, I had been intuitively working with that just by turning the knob of my electric piano, self-selecting the speed of the vibrato. I didn't know I was affecting my brainwaves in 1970 when I first got the instrument. But
right.
I was naturally doing it, and it was later on finding, oh, that's the same speed as this bowl. That's the same speed as my electric piano. Aha!
Right.
I knew it before I knew it.
Right. So you mentioned right at the beginning a particular instrument that you used in the chakra suite.
Right.
And I noticed that it has a particular kind of timbre that sounds like a vibraphone.
Exactly.
And is that why you use that one?
Well, it chose me. And in fact, yes. When I heard and I had my vision under the redwoods, that's the instrument I heard. What I had forgotten is that I got kicked out of the orchestra storeroom on several occasions when I snuck in when no one else was around to play the vibraphone and the vibraharp they had there, because that, again, was this smooth metallic sound. But vibraphone, you have to use mallets. I wanted to play a keyboard, and I wanted something, because I didn't own one, that I could sit down and just go into, you know, space and into the meditative zone. And when I first had that experience, that's when I started getting into that on piano. But then, having heard this other instrument, I didn't know that it really existed until I, shortly after that, saw Herbie Hancock. In fact, my band was opening for him at a jazz club in San Francisco, and he had one of the first of these electric pianos designed and invented by Harold Rhodes, and then Harold licensed to the Fender Musical Instrument Company. That's why people knew this as the Fender Rhodes electric piano. But that sound instantly put me into the zone. And I sold my second guitar, my second trumpet. As soon as I knew that that was available, I said, I have to have one. That's necessary for my soul and to play the music that I'm hearing in my head. And that's why my first recording featured that instrument rather than grand piano. So the sound itself and the complete non-anticipatory music in the moment, music that anchors you into the now, played on an instrument, I knew that was the best way to introduce the music.
All right. So it's amazing how spirit guides us and leads us to the places where we need to be, and we get the most amazing stuff out of it. You talk about listening to the spaces between the notes as a way of deeply listening. Yeah, I think I love it. I think it was Miles Davis that said, it's not the notes you play, it's the notes you don't. And you pointed out Deepak Chopra, he talks about the gap between thoughts as a way to access the field of infinite possibilities. And graphic artists talk about this, the concept of negative space, which is actually the shape that is left when you remove what's in the foreground, as a powerful place for something miraculous to happen, a subconscious place. What is it about the space between the notes?
Well, I think you just also tapped into one of the metaphors that I've used and understood from art, that when you take out the most obvious part that people typically focus on and bring the background into the foreground, well, that was my concept, which I was writing about and playing music several years before Eno coined, you know, popularized that as ambient music. That was what ambient used to mean, that it was background without the foreground. And when you don't have something to focus on, that allows your brain to shift gears. It slows down and says, oh, nothing too much interesting here. We'll go back into, like, neutral zone. Well, in terms of listening to the space between the notes, and you're right, Miles said that. When I listen to the space between notes, I get into such deep silence that's where I make my deepest connection to what I've learned is the quantum field. That's where at least my brain gets into a vibratory shift and a high coherence pattern. So something special was going on when, at least for me, I'm in that state. What we've also learned is when the musician is in that state and records music or plays music live, that will entrain people who listen to the music. And it holds on recordings as well. So once I record with that brain state, where I'm in, that makes it easier for other people to access that state. With Deepak Chopra and Wayne Dyer talking about the infinite potential, the place of infinite possibilities, the gap between thoughts. Well, I'm not thinking when I'm in that state. So when they started saying that, I said, well, that's exactly where I am. I'm totally in the now, totally in the moment. I don't know what I'm going to play 2 seconds or 5 seconds in the future when I'm at the keyboard. With the music that really started coming through when I was recording Paradigm Shift on January 4th, 2009, I had some major surprises where I remember for a second thinking, wow, I've never thought of that before. And that was the whole point. I didn't have to think. It just channeled through. And I've learned to shut down that mental conversation in my mind. And that's why listening to the spaces between the notes shuts down the chatter. One of the hardest things for everybody to do when they're meditating is to shut down that mental chatter. Well, for me, getting into that space where I'm waiting for the next bit of music that's going to come through to manifest, to let me know I actually will hear that. As I listen with a sustain pedal down on the piano, also the notes that I play with my fingers blend and make new notes from the combination of the harmonics. So if I don't listen deeply, I don't know what to play.
Right, right. So we talked a little bit about the jazz part. So maybe this is a good time to play a little bit from Snake Charmer.
Absolutely. And let me just set up a little bit. This began on the Saturday night 3-hour trance dance in a workshop run by Jean Houston. She anointed me drum chief, where I was in charge of playing conga drums, keeping the participants dancing for 3 hours nonstop. I mean, it's very hard to play 3 hours nonstop if you're thinking. And at one point during the program, I was joined by another drummer. He started playing this amazing rhythm that just put us all deep into trance. I said, we need to record that. That's the conga and drum and Dumbek rhythm you hear in the background. And I learned later on that there was, we actually had tapped into something that was a secret rhythm of a sacred priestess lineage.
Again, really, really, really powerful music and beautiful and delightful. It's I don't even know what to say about.
Right, it's hard to talk after that.
There's a softness and a melting kind of experience that happens. You know, I feel like you use the phrase melting into the music. And you also said that when you're in the state, when your brainwaves are entrained into one of these mystical states, the music carries the imprint of that. And
oh, yes.
It conveys back out to the listener.
That is a very important principle, which is another one, I believe, of the insights that I really helped bring through. The phrase that I used years ago was, music is a carrier wave of consciousness.
A carrier wave for consciousness. And this reminded me of the classical Indian music notion that when a really evolved Indian musician plays a raga, they're actually putting the audience in touch with a form, a being, an entity, some element of the creation. It's like it brings you into communion with something, right? And when you share that music is a carrier wave for consciousness, is that kind of what you're talking about?
Absolutely. And that's not just this music. It's any music is going to have an effect on you. You will be affected by the music itself, the consciousness of the musician who's playing the music, the emotional state. The question is, how do you want to be stimulated? Obviously, the angry rap and hip-hop artists coming from a very different place of ego. Many classical musicians, according to Dr. John Diamond, who did the early research on this, said they're coming from ego, and it's like, as opposed to sharing love with the audience. And in my own case, what's always been true for me is the deep meditation states that I go into become part of the whole music soundscape, although you can't necessarily easily hear it, but you can feel it. And some scientists have been able to measure it. In the early days, John Diamond, with his book, Your Body Doesn't Lie, and behavioral kinesiology and muscle testing, really gave us a way to show that that is true. And if a musician, for instance, John, is stressed, even if they play all the notes right, that stress will come out in the performance, and you listen to that, and your muscles will weaken if you test them. And as Robert Palmer talks about in his lecture on the master musicians of Shizuoka, the musicians were priestcraft, and their job was to go into trance, and in so doing, entrance the whole village.
Wow. It's fascinating stuff. Okay, so I want to share with the listeners, I realize that we've had this conversation between Stephen and I, and I have been so into this conversation that I have neglected to take a break. So hopefully in post-production, I'll be able to insert some breaks here. But we've been at this for going on almost 2 hours, and I don't want to stop. But we're going to have to stop. But before we do, you had the opportunity. You played at the Parliament of World Religions. You opened for the Dalai Lama. Music, you said music is non-denominational without dogma. You shared that it's a trance inducer that is legal and free and not pharmaceutical. I'm reading a book called The World is Sound, Nada Brahma, which talks about sound as the essence of creation, like it's
yes.
The prime mover. How deep does the rabbit hole go, right? If you take music and ride it, where can we go?
We don't know. I mean, on one level, we're still just on the surface, but I'd say definitely using the combination of music that comes through from these deeper levels when I'm in a state, when other musicians are in a state where they are tapping into that when they're playing and recording, and then also adding the brainwaves, it's a very powerful setting and a resource that can take people deeper. If you listen as background, not that deep, but if you give your full attention and set the intention to go deep and have the music transport you to a very deep brainwave state yourself, well, then you'll have your own experience. We don't yet know. And the reality is there's no research that's going on because good research is really expensive. And the only research that I know about that's gone on with the power of music to put people into those kind of states, and that's advertisers who want you to be more receptive to what they're selling.
Right.
So I think we're still at the beginning. The reality is that people need to do the work themselves. They need to give themselves, whether it's 5 minutes or 10 minutes or 20 minutes or an hour. And I say, because I do this for myself, at least once a week, where close your eyes, maybe with headphones, no visual distractions. You may want to be sitting in meditative posture. You may want to be lying down, but be totally with the music.
So most of your albums, as we've talked about, don't have an anchoring percussion line, but Drum Spirit does.
And so does Deja Blues.
Deja Blues does too, right. So tell us a little bit about Drum Spirit.
I was at the... the New Living Expo in San Francisco, and went to hear the lecture by Danny and Brinkley. He was being introduced by someone who started chanting and changed the energy of the entire expo. And Danny said, you two guys need to meet. His name was Chief Sonny Reyna, Intertribal Peace Chief. And we met, and he said, you are the person that Spirit sent to help me produce my album. So that was our introduction. And we went into the studio. We recorded his songs. I added guitar and bass and synthesizers to that album. And that album was called Healing Songs of Earth and Sky. And John, about two-thirds of the way through that recording session, which was just him and his drum and a rattle, and then he would put that down and say, this song goes with this drum and this rattle. And two-thirds of the way through, he picked up another one. It was visibly a bigger drum and a bigger shaker. And as soon as he started playing it, I felt the hair on my neck stand up, and I started hearing all this other music. And that's how it happened. I instantly knew there was a whole other album that was going to be built just on that one rhythm.
Amazing.
And that music just takes us into the state. I've heard that a lot of Tantra teachers and Tantra couples have used that album, as also with Here to Eternity and Deja Blues. It sets up a very powerful resonance and entrainment between lovers. So it helps you breathe together and groove together and go into that same loving rapport, heart-opening, chakra-opening state. And that's a lot of what's happening with that album.
All right. So we're just about out of time. Can you any last thoughts you want to share with our listeners about your work and the power of music and what you've discovered?
Well, as I was mentioning right before, give yourself the opportunity to be with the music. This music that I've been involved with, other music of your favorite, and don't multitask, at least some of the times. Just be totally with the music. Allow the music to take you to the space where that music goes. There are so many great musicians who are working today. You know, choose your favorites, and when you find them, even if it's only 5 minutes a day, get yourself into a deep, truly relaxing stage where your body can recalibrate, can reset your stress level, and so many helpful things happen with that. It will be profound, and that's a gift that's there for all of us.
Fantastic.
Visit me at my website. It's www.stevenhalpern.com. That's StevenHalpern.com. I have a YouTube channel, youtube.com/StevenHalpernMusic, and a little bit of Facebook, facebook.com/StevenHalpernMusic, and a lot of articles, a lot of samples on my website. The longest and best-sounding samples on the Internet are on my website, and it's cool if people want to buy the music at Amazon or iTunes, but I have typically 90-second samples at really high res that you can really get a sense of what is going on with the music, and those are the best ways to get in touch with me.
All right, Stephen, we're gonna go out on Paradigm Shift from, and that is from the Drum Spirit album, is that right?
Paradigm Shift is from its own album, which was named that because in that session, I, again, not having a lot of expectations, but setting the stage and affirming, and towards the end of that session, playing a lot of nice music, something very magical happened. I virtually levitated off the piano bench and started playing some pieces of music that I had never played before and had a very deep experience, and that is encoded in the music with no extra brainwave entrainment added.
All right, so this is Paradigm Shift from the album Paradigm Shift. Thank you, Stephen, so much for your time today. We really enjoyed it.
I've enjoyed being with you. This was great.
A personal tarot reading can offer you insight, information, enlightenment, and empowerment along your life's path. Hi C is a professional tarot conversationalist and ritualist with over 10 years' experience. He's available for readings in a variety of formats, including parties and events. To schedule your personal tarot reading, contact Hi C at tarotbyhic.net or email him at hic@fireflywillows.com.
Reflections along the path. What is yin? What is yin? Rather than read about it and collect opinions and observations and analysis from others' experiences, I've been trying to understand the Tao from first principles through my own experiences. It is said that the Tao that can be explained is not the true Tao. So I'm very mindful of that caution, both as I attempt to explain and, perhaps more importantly, as I explore. Because one of the things I love to do is gather and catalog the experiences of a certain thing that will help me explain. Sometimes that interferes with the exploring. It stunts some of the experience of the mystery, some of the release into the mystery. Being a guy and an Aries, I have come to accept and understand how my perception of the world is colored by my yang perspective. For a very long time, my entire experience, even sleep and vacations, were active principle, yang-driven experiences. What can I learn during dream time tonight? What is the optimal expenditure of attention on this vacation? How do I get the most out of each moment? It's all been a very intense and driven way of being. I've come to recognize that that process has handicapped me, retarded my growth by limiting my engagement with the unknown in favor of pursuing a harvest in the known. The idea of waiting for something to come to me instead of me pursuing it, how silly, just go for it. Except if you never sit in stillness, you can only get what you go for. And by definition, you can only go for something you suspect or know exists. That leads to very few surprises. So lately, I've been choosing to let go of the yang, the pursuer role, and explore, tentatively and, I admit, clumsily, the yin, how to receive. The yin, it seems to me, lies at the heart of mystery. One can pursue healing, or one can declare oneself open to receiving it. One can pursue knowledge, or one can declare oneself open to receiving it. One can pursue a relationship, or declare oneself open to receiving one. It strikes me that the Native American vision quest is both yin and yang. It starts with yang-style preparation, the purification, the fasting, the setting of oneself out on the hill. Even the sitting and praying is yang, because the intention is to quest. So when does the yin phase begin? Ah, and here lies the mystery. I was led to an understanding of Odin's quest while meditating under my redwood tree. Odin quested for knowledge and power. What I was shown was a little different from the traditional story. I saw a powerful warrior and clan leader, bold, even arrogant, demanding more wisdom and power from the gods. His motives? Certainly, it was to benefit his people, but there was also some ego involved. I witnessed him vow to climb the tallest tree, to literally reach out to the gods and grab hold of them and shake them if necessary to claim his prize. He went prepared, with his sword to compel the gods, with enough food and water, and with rope to assist his climb. Just getting into a tree that large required rope. And climb he did, higher and higher. And then it happened. His human imperfection caught up with him. He slipped and fell, down through the tree, crashing against the boughs. His own sword stabbed him in the side, and the rope he had coiled around his waist snagged on a branch, unwound, and luckily snagged around his leg and snapped his fall to a halt. And there he was, bloodied by his own sword, hanging helplessly upside down from the world tree, unable to reach the ground, too wounded and weak to hoist himself up the rope that held him. For 9 days and 9 nights he hung there. It took that long for his fury to wane into exhaustion, his pain to wane into song. And then, and only then, that's when it happened. That's when the runes were revealed. The shift in his consciousness was overwhelming. The symbols, the power of written symbols to convey meaning, to uncover patterns in nature, to communicate and conjure. He had no idea what a rune was. He had no way of knowing, of anticipating this new way of seeing, this new power of comprehension. His yang intention was just the prologue. The depth of the gift was revealed only at the moment of yin. The mystery. So we see the yin sneaking in the back door. It settles on us only when we are not looking. It emerges in the space between the thoughts, in the notes we don't play, at the moment between the exhalation and the inhalation. It finds us when we are empty, exhausted, asleep. So I can pursue, or I can declare myself open to receive wisdom. But even that declaration is yang, because I am naming my quarry, my desired communion. Deeper yin is to simply declare oneself open to receive, to offer oneself into the state of receptivity. But still there is yang. The declaration itself, the attitude of placing the self, that too is yang. I find this fascinating. As close as I can come to the yin, within it exists the yang, that little white circle in the field of black. When I did Zen meditation with Robert Jackson of A Quiet Mind, he counseled that we should embrace an attitude of no constructive action. At the time, I didn't understand it. Now it's more clear to me. Simply being, without any intention, is the closest I can come to understanding the posture, the attitude, the embodiment of yin. I find this embodiment, too, in the practice of yogic breathing. Breathing into a part of my body that wants to be opened or needs healing, or that I'm just developing an awareness of. It's not the breathing into part that's yin. Nope, that's still yang. But gently, tentatively, non-judgmentally experiencing the feelings I feel before I analyze them, that's the yin. This perception of yin has recently been augmented by a deepening understanding of the nature of plants and, too, the nature of my spouse. As masculine fire sign active principle Aries as I am, my spouse is feminine water sign Cancer quiet. It's taken me a long time to understand the many messages I've received from spirit about her. Usually the message is along the same theme. See and understand the divine feminine. Yeah, well, not as easy as it sounds, because every model of the ideal female, my undeveloped interpretation of the divine feminine, that I've typically conjured includes a whole lot more yang active principle than that little white circle, and more than I sense from my spouse. One day I realized that, well, I was led to observe is perhaps a better way to say it, that Debbie is a plant, rooted, quiet, minimal motion, minimal doing, minimal drama. Like a plant, absorbing the light and gradually, slowly, almost incidentally really, seeking it. The same with the roots
and the drawing up of water. What's there is there. Let that be enough. While it's not a perfect analogy, it seemed to me in that moment that animals do, while plants are more inclined to be. And guess what? That works for them. In fact, it works so well that they are far and away the most successful life form on the planet. I mentioned this observation to Daniel Foer, a colleague and teacher of plant spirit medicine, and he said, yes, plants certainly are more yin than animals. But even they do. They search for light and root for water. And by the way, the more science learns about plants, the more doing behavior we discover in them. And then Daniel added, but the rocks, they're really yin. And so they are. Much more passive, much more quiescent, much more canvas than artist, much more receptive to the experiences around them than active shapers of that experience. So I learned even more about the divine feminine, the yin, in that moment. A human in meditation. A wild animal asleep in its nest. A plant. A rock. Each more yin than the previous. Where does it lead? All the way down to, say, the subatomic particle. A neutron is a neutron is a neutron, from the beginning of time until the end, from the Big Bang to the ashatan. As is a proton, as is an electron, or so it mostly seems. So in aggregate, all of creation, at its very core, is yin. And yet, it's all in motion. It swirls and fizzes and fusions and maelstroms. It laughs and cries and grows and dies. All these verbs, all yang. So just as it was hard to escape the yang within the yin, so too do we find the yin at the heart of all this yang. The Tao that can be explained is not the true Tao. Not by a long shot. We'll be right back.
Life comes at you pretty fast, and you're doing the best you can. But maybe you could use a little help. Are you looking for answers or feeling a little stuck? Something nagging you that you and your doctor can't quite explain? Or maybe you're looking to enhance your game or improve your performance at work? Consider a visit with John Carosella at The Shamanist. Whether you need a little guidance or even a little miracle, John can help. Visit in person or connect by phone or Skype. Schedule a rune, oracle, or tarot reading. Experience a shamanic counseling session. Or a Reju Kido or shamanic healing session for body and soul. Experience more of your world and yourself. The sky's the limit when you tap into the realities that are just beyond our sight. Mention this ad and receive a special gift when you book your first session with John. For a little help, or maybe a little miracle, theshamanist.com.
Well, that's our show. Hope you enjoyed it. We went a little longer this time. Sorry for that long stretch without a break. But I hope you enjoyed the interview with Stephen Halpern and his music as much as I did. We appreciate your support. You can post your thoughts and comments on our Facebook page, facebook.com/fireflywillows. And you can always drop me a note, jc@fireflywillows.com. And if you would like to support the show, contributions in any amount are deeply appreciated. You can send something to our PayPal account, convergence@fireflywillows.com. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, I'm John Carosella.
Thank you for joining us. This program was brought to you by Firefly Willows LIVE. We hope you enjoyed the show. This is Deb Carosella. Please join us next time on Firefly Willows LIVE for our live on-air call-in show, Sunday morning at 10:30 a.m. Ooh, 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 ooh.